Good morning, Portland, Maine. You're listening to Tad Smart Talk with Steve-O. It is Saturday, March 29th. This is show number 105. Where does the time go? You're listening to News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Shani, how are we doing?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
Doing fantastic. We have two very special interviews today. In just a few minutes, we will have an interview that was recorded a few days ago with Janet Mills. Janet is the Attorney General here in Maine. I had the pleasure of spending about 40 minutes with Attorney General Mills, and we're talking about what's going on in Maine, what the Attorney General is responsible for in our state, and all things politics. It was especially a treat to talk to AG Mills. Last year, interviewed Peter Mills, her brother, who's the head of the Turnpike Authority, who's been involved in politics for many, many years. And then just a few months ago, Dora Mills, who was at University of New England, and she was the head of Maine Health, I think, for a long time. And so I am working my way through the entire Mills family. And what a nice group between Dora and Peter and Janet. And they've done so much here in the state. And so you'll hear that interview in just about 8 or 9 minutes, so please hang in there. And then we will be taking a quick news break at the top of the hour, and then 12:06, another special guest, Dr. Kevin Strange. Dr. Strange is the president of Mount Desert Island Biological Lab. We'll be talking about science. We'll be talking about education here in Maine. And that will be a fascinating interview for the entire second hour at 12:06. So if you're interested in Attorney General and what the Attorney General does in the state, or Janet Mills, that'll be in a few minutes. And then in the second hour, we will be talking about the Mount Desert Island Biological Lab, which is doing some really groundbreaking research up there at MDI. Let's get to on this day. Today, March 29th. I think that all that really matters is it's a little bit warmer today than it has been in the last few weeks.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, this feels like the longest winter. It feels like it just doesn't end. And I think everyone's ready for, I think baseball starts up in the next week. I think everyone's ready, so hopefully that the warming trend continues. On this day, March 29th, a somber entry here. On this day, March 29th, 1973, that was when the last U.S. troops left South Vietnam. That ended the military conflict in Vietnam. Certainly a difficult time in American history. Moving on this day, 1992, Democratic presidential frontrunner Bill Clinton acknowledged experimenting with marijuana, which at the time, which 22 years ago, was a bit of a scandal. Do you have that clip?
When I was in England, I experimented with marijuana a time or two, and I didn't like it, and didn't inhale, and never tried it again.
Yeah, that was Bill. I am actually... I don't want to say I'm a fan, but I appreciate the work that Bill Clinton did when he was in office. Clearly, there were some issues involving extramarital affairs and his testimony before Congress that I think really obviously hurt his presidency. But I think that a lot of the work that he did should probably stand on its own as being, in my mind, a very effective president. Let's see, 1999 on this day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed above 10,000. For those of you wondering, what is the Dow Jones? It was created by Wall Street Journal editor and co-founder Charles Dow. So that's where the Dow Jones name comes from. 5-6 years ago, when the economy started tanking and there was a crisis on Wall Street and Lehman Brothers and a bunch of institutions were going belly up, in the middle of all that, or maybe it was just slightly before that, Martha Stewart went to jail for, I think it was just for a few months, but for there's a different legal term, but the reality is it was involving insider trading. Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
So here you have Martha Stewart, and clearly she broke the law, but it was in the context of telling her stockbroker to sell out of some stock that she owned. And it was only a few tens of thousands of dollars, relatively not a lot of money, especially for Martha Stewart. So she went to prison. But yet we've gone through this incredible upheaval on Wall Street and financial institutions. Billions of dollars have been lost. And it doesn't feel like hardly anyone else has gone to prison. And it's just, it's always struck me as kind of absurd, the image of Martha Stewart going to prison and all these people, mostly guys, who manipulated the stock market, manipulated with all these derivatives, created hardship without exaggerating. You know, many people lost their life savings, all because, I don't know if I should call them crooks, but I just did. But not everyone on Wall Street is a crook. Certainly not everyone in banking is a crook. There's a lot of honest, honorable people. But hopefully, when the economy tanked and the stock market tanked, the big discussion was, we need reform. We need to fix too big to fail. We need to protect Main Street more than Wall Street. All this other rhetoric. I'm not sure if it's changed, because many of the people on Wall Street, they're so politically connected. They're so interconnected with lawyers, and it's almost like the game is fixed, where the way that they're handling money, the loopholes in the law, and then in the middle of all that, Martha Stewart has to put away her cookbooks for a few months, go to, I think it was a federal prison in Connecticut. But I'm not saying that she shouldn't have been punished for what she did. It just seemed, it always struck me as just the juxtaposition between her going to prison and many of the people that were responsible for billions of dollars of losses kind of skated because of the technicalities. Birthdays on this day, March 29th. Cy Young. Many people are familiar with the Cy Young Award, but may not be familiar with the man himself. He was a legendary Hall of Fame pitcher. His birthday in 1867, passed away in 1955. We have, in 1968, Lucy Lawless, who was famous for her role as Xena, Warrior Princess. She turns 46. You ever watch that show?
I have to say, I did not.
Really?
No. Did you?
Not really. I'm familiar with it. I think, yeah, she was kind of a superhero. And anyone with the name Xena, Warrior Princess probably involves some sort of superhero thing.
And I don't think she wore a lot of clothing. I think that was part of the appeal, too, like a bikini fighting.
I don't know about that. She was a warrior princess. I think she probably had a warrior princess outfit.
Okay.
We'll have to check on that. Moving on, 1967, birthday this day, John Popper, frontman for Blues Traveler, known for the songs Run Around. Here's one of his hit songs, Blues Traveler. He hasn't done much lately, has he?
He's lost a lot of weight.
Oh, that's his activity lately?
I don't know musically what he's been up to, but I know physically he lost a lot of weight. He was a very, very big man. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, he played the harmonica. He used to have this vest with like 100 harmonicas on it or something.
That's right.
Crazy like that. Hey, the other thing that's in the news, which I just noticed in the news, let me see if I can find my notes here. The student debt was just calculated this last week as being $1 trillion of student debt. Obviously, the biggest amount there's ever been. There are 37 million people in the U.S. saddled with approximately $1 trillion in student debt. And here are some sobering stats. The median income a few years ago for a household without debt. So a household that had no student debt, the median income was about $117,000, nearly three times the net worth for people, for households where there was student debt of $42,000. About 40% of households led by somebody 35 or younger have student debt. Any feeling on the whole student debt thing, Shani?
I can empathize with what people are going through, that's for sure. I'm burdened with that student debt myself, and it's hard to get out from under.
What would you like to see the government do? Because there's arguments, some people suggest that, geez, let's forgive the debt. That doesn't feel like it would be fair for people who paid for college. And there are other people saying that the terms should be different. Have you read anything, or do you have any thoughts in terms of what you would like to see in terms of policy shift in that?
Personally, I would like the debt to be forgiven. I think that makes the most sense to me.
Well, I think we have to be realistic. I think it may make the most sense for you, but I don't know if we can afford to forgive $1 trillion.
I understand. I mean, there are also things like, you know, state grants. Like out in California, there's the governor's grant where you can attend community colleges for free. There needs to be more.
I think here in Maine, if we can keep more people here in Maine, you know, we have an outflow of young people 18 to 34, whether they're educated in Maine or they're educated elsewhere and then they end up back in Maine. You know, I'd be supportive of coming up with some mechanism relative to student debt that didn't erase all of it, but basically came up with some benefit for people who are willing to work here in Maine, who are paying taxes in Maine, contributing to the economy, and giving some sort of scale or looking at some sort of scale that address that.
That's good.
You think we should start there?
Yep. I think that's a great place to start.
Because we've got to do something. And, you know, the issue of debt and the issue of what's going on in education right now, there's less government funding in education and research. And so all these things are kind of intersecting, really creating some hardship for a lot of people. And I think the government should look at that in some way. I want to get to this interview that we have coming up with Janet Mills. And so you're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. We will play my interview with Janet Mills, and we'll talk about all things Maine, all things about being Attorney General, the political landscape. Her and her family have had just a fascinating history here in Maine. And then in the second hour, we will have Kevin Strange. And that interview is also interesting. Dr. Kevin Strange, he's the president of Mount Desert Island Biological Lab. They're doing a lot of breakthrough research. So thank you for listening to Tide Smart Talk, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. That could be the other song. I fought the law and the law won. Please join me in welcoming the top law official in the state of Maine, Attorney General Janet Mills. Welcome, Janet.
Hey, thanks for having me, Steve.
Do you play the theme music up in the Attorney General's office?
We should. I've decided after visiting here that we should have theme music, yes.
Yeah, it makes theme music goes well with everything.
Right. Instead of music.
I know. I fought the law and the law won. Well, let's start. Thank you so much. As we talked before going on the air, I've met with your brother who's been a guest in the show a few months ago. Your sister Dora was on talking about health care, and I'm trying to go through the whole family tree, the Mills tree. And so we have a best, we can do a whole week at some point, a best
of.
Oh dear. And it's exciting to have you here in the studio, so thank you for making time to come.
Thank you.
If you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about your background in terms of growing up and being born and raised in Farmington, in a little bit what brought you to the point where you're now the Attorney General, then we'll talk about what's going on in Maine and the role of Attorney General. But I'd like to get a little bit of the backstory for people that may be listening that may not be familiar with your family history.
Sure. Thank you, Steve. I did grow up in Farmington, Maine. My grandmother, on her side of the family, were founding members of the founding families of Farmington. On my mother's and my father's side, and my grandfather on my father's side was from Stonington, and my grandmother and grandfather on my mother's side were from Ashland. So we spent a lot of our youth traveling around visiting old homesteads. But I was privileged to be born and raised in a small town with a university campus, which is always a boon economically and academically to us townies. I went to Colby College for a year and a half, and then I dropped out and worked for a couple of years, and I went to UMass Boston. I ended up going to Paris for a year, and coming back and getting a degree from UMass Boston in French. So, and then I worked for a couple more years and came back to Maine and went to law school and been back ever since. I went to the Attorney General's office right out of law school, became a prosecutor, was the first woman in the criminal division of the AG's office, started prosecuting homicides and other major crimes, and then I became the first woman district attorney, elected district attorney in New England, and I served in that capacity for 15 years, covering Androscoggin, Franklin, and Oxford counties, and that was a fun job, too, managing an office with 9 trial courts and all appeals to the Maine Supreme Court and doing all kinds of crimes except for murder.
Wow.
So I had a good crew, and after 15 years, I said that was enough. Ran for Congress in the primary and lost to John Baldacci. Then was in private practice with my brother Peter for a time and also ran for the legislature. So Peter and I were both in the legislature at the same time. For a while. We were both in the House for one term. That was fun. He on the far side of the room on the Republican side, me on the opposite side on the Democratic side. We see eye to eye on a lot of things, nevertheless.
Well, that's certainly an incredible pedigree. We have Attorney General Janet Mills here. If you wouldn't mind, I'd love to talk about, I'm fascinated by your family background in terms of your dad serving as a U.S. attorney, your growing up in a family that was really immersed in both political and civic service and civil service, and really every member of your family, you know, looking through my notes here. But, and I also want to talk a little bit about the dichotomy of growing up in what would probably be classified as a Republican household. In Maine back then was dominated by, I think, Republican yep. politics.
Sure.
But at what point you diverged, I think it was in the 70s, and in your notes you talk about women's rights and your education. But talk about the family background, because I've tried to instill in my kids a sense of getting involved with mm-hmm. government. And in my notes, I talked about your dad being appointed by Margaret Chase Smith, who's one of the icons of Maine politics, and also talk about Eisenhower coming through your small town when you were, like, really young and yeah. having memories of Eisenhower yeah. coming in to meet with Margaret Chase Smith. And yeah. talk about how that kind of formed your interest and involvement in government and politics from being involved at such an early age.
Well, I don't want to give the wrong impression. I didn't grow up thinking I was going to be involved in politics or public service or law. I never thought of myself as becoming a lawyer until, you know, in my late 20s, and my dad said, well, you know, you might want to think about going to law school. I said, me? Really? I've been doing all kinds of other things, you know. And he persuaded me it was a good idea, and I did come back to Maine to go to law school. But I was always in awe of Margaret Chase Smith. She was a good friend of the family, lived just down the road in Skowhegan. But when it came time for me to register to vote for the first time, I registered and enrolled as a Democrat. Because I knew I'd been away and I'd been working on different causes and different issues, and I knew that the Democratic Party was more along my line of thinking.
And how did that go over with the family?
Well, you know, I didn't exactly make a public announcement. But as time passed, all the women in my family became Democrats, and all the men remained Republicans. I'm the white sheep.
Does that symbolize anything in terms of what issues are important, or are their parties more aligned with social issues or women's issues that are more core to what's important to you? Or
maybe, and also just tradition. I think my brother Peter considers himself a Teddy Roosevelt Republican.
Right.
And I think my father the same. But when you grew up in rural Maine, outside of the county, you almost were, everybody was a Republican. It was Republican territory up until Ed Muskie ran. And then even then, most of rural Maine remained Republican.
And to this day, family get-togethers, I mean, do you have spirited discussions or debates, or does anyone ever throw the turkey across the room at Thanksgiving?
Not at all. We fight over the giblets.
That's funny. One of the things that, a quote that you gave a few years ago, which I thought was great.
Jeez, you've done some research. This is scary.
No, this is a big-time show. By the way, we have Attorney General Janet Mills here. A few years ago, when you were talking about the family dichotomy in terms of your dad's roots as U.S. attorney and being involved with as a Republican, the guys being Republicans, and you and your sisters leaning more as Democrat, you had a quote which I thought is apropos of what's happening now. And the quote is, "My family always looked at politics as a clean calling." There was never a disparaging word said about the other candidates that I recall and the candidates whom they did not support. There was no put-downs. Nobody ever said he's a bum or she's a bum. And you talked a little bit about that and in the reference of Margaret Chase Smith being representing a different era yeah. of people could have different ideology, people could have different positions, but you called it politics is a clean calling, and I don't know if now in 2014 anyone would use that as a descriptor. And I wanted you to kind of look back on what you meant by that in that time and where you think we are now to the clean or not so clean calling of politics.
Well, I think there have been a lot of disparaging things said in the context of political campaigns and in the context of legislating, but it doesn't need to be the case. You can look at more modern examples right here in Cumberland County. Carl Turner and Joel Abramson, prominent Republicans who always kept their head high. Sawin Millett, who's held different positions in state government and who is the budget officer for the and commissioner for the current governor. I served with him, and I served with a lot of Democrats who also held their heads high and were able to debate and compromise and give and take. And I served on the Appropriations Committee for 4 years in the Maine State Legislature. That's a rough-and-tumble atmosphere and a very emotionally charged atmosphere. But when it came right down to it, we had to figure out what was the most important thing in our party's agenda, what was the most important thing on our side of the horseshoe and the other side of the horseshoe. We knew we had to have a unanimous budget, and that was more important than anything. And when it came down to it, things came to a head in a very pleasant way. And I guess you always hear and see the worst. That's what makes press. The bad stuff is what gets coverage in the newspaper and TV, unfortunately. But yeah, I would like to see more civility in government. Prominent Republicans and prominent Democrats have all said that. They'd like to see a more civilized way of doing things.
Is there anything specific here in Maine, or do you feel as though it's the political climate across the country? We obviously see this contentiousness in Washington, D.C., and then we see it in, I believe, in recent years in Augusta. And now, I believe, my kind of hypothesis is that it's even trickling down to local municipality governments. There's a lot of local towns where there have been recalls, town managers been fired, councilors, and the meetings have gotten more aggressive. And I don't know if that's just a sign of very challenging economic times and people trying to transfer their frustration onto elected officials, or if democracy itself is going through a change. What's your thought on that relative to Maine?
Well, part of that, I think, thank you, Steve, part of that is the good and bad of transparency. And I get to watch my local town selectman meetings, and I'm going to a town meeting tonight. I'm going to voice my opinion on a number of issues, and it will be done, I think, in a civil manner. But I watch our selectmen's meetings, both in Wilton and Farmington, on local public access TV. And they know we're keeping an eye on them. So I don't think it gets out of hand, at least in my area it doesn't. But I would like to see civics come back into the school curriculum too. I think that's an important item for students, take part in civics. And I think we're not – Sandra Day O'Connor has been on the speaking tour for a couple of years now talking about this same thing. And I think it's important to inculcate in our high school and middle school students the importance of civil debate. The importance of partaking in democracy and doing so in an intelligent and honest manner.
You just echoed the Steve-O educational platform program on civics.
Oh.
And we didn't set this up before, did we?
Did not.
Last year, Maine graduated almost 12,000 seniors, right? My hypothesis is that in most school districts, they teach civics as part of American history in 5th and 7th grade. We graduate out of the 12,000, a high percent are either 18 or they're about to be 18 by the time they're June 1st municipality elections. The percentages are in the fraction in terms of people. We're graduating almost 12,000 young adults every year that most of them, do not know the difference between a referendum and a refrigerator. And if we're going to tell them that government's important, politics is important, policy is important, and we're not preparing them for the first time they're eligible to vote, I think it's an insult to democracy. And that people, the brave men and women, are now fighting to preserve democracy, and we can't do a better job. So I'm proposing across the state that not a complete change of curriculum, but just for 6 hours in the last month mm-hmm. of a senior year. You know, and that time for many seniors is wasted anyhow. Your exams yeah. are taken. You know what you're doing the following year. 1 hour, talk about local municipality yeah. government, 1 hour county government, 1 hour state legislature, 1 hour federal government. And even if we're giving them just a little bit of information before they go through the portal of turning 18 yeah. and voting, I think it's critical.
Well, and I'm a big fan of bringing members of the American Legion
oh, right.
into the schools and having them, those who were left of the World War II generation, the Vietnam era, the Korean era, those generations, talk to the students about what the military really means and why, what kinds of rights they preserved for these students.
And I think when we talk about the contentiousness, I think a lot of it can be attributed to the last 50 years, the electorate being less and less engaged in terms of what's going, whether it's our foreign policy, whether it's people serving in the military. We've become very good at isolating ourselves from the reality of what's going on. And in the absence of that, it allows people to be very tribal in their politics. It allows people to say, I'm Democrat, I'm Republican, I believe this. You know, President Obama must have been born in Kenya. And it's like, really? I don't know. It seems like Hawaii is the right answer there. But it allows people, it allows them to add levels of irrationality and emotion. Mm-hmm. And most of these problems we have, I believe, even if they're large problems, can really be sorted out if people sit down with good intentions and say, let's work on this.
If people read what they should be reading and dig into the facts and not just buy into the hyperbole and the sound bites on certain TV and radio stations.
I agree. Well, they're not going to find that hyperbole here at Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. Nothing but the facts.
Teaching citizenship is important.
Oh, I think it's critical. Because I think, you know, our democracy is 238 years old, I think, or something like that. And there are countries across the country, there are countries around the world that are making such great sacrifices for a taste of democracy. Yeah. We have it. We have the leadership position. And if we don't invest a little bit of time, a little bit of sacrifice in our democracy, and again, I think that's the undermining, one of the undermining conditions. But
I agree with you there.
By the way, we have Maine's Attorney General, Janet Mills, here in the studio. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O and News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. For those listening, everyone's familiar with the term Attorney General. And we have Attorney General of the United States, and generally every state has an Attorney General. And for folks listening that may not be familiar, talk a little bit about what the role and what the oversight of Maine's Attorney General, the Office of Attorney General, really does.
Sure. I think people see the term Attorney General in the news once in a while. It makes a big splash when we make some political announcement or some announcement about a murder case or some major fraud case. The Attorney General in Maine is elected by the legislature. It's the only state in the country where the Attorney General is elected by the legislature. So in five other states, the governor of those states appoints the Attorney General. And in a couple of states, the person is appointed by the Supreme Court, in Tennessee, for instance. But in Maine, the Attorney General, since 1855, is appointed or elected by the legislature.
So it's part of our state constitution.
It is. It is.
And does it require a majority in both the state Senate and House? And how is mm-hmm. the protocol handled with every new legislative session?
It's a joint convention of the House and Senate, and it's the first thing that the joint convention, first thing that the new legislature does, and I think it's one of the most important things that they do, is to elect the constitutional officers, the Secretary of State, the Treasurer, and the Attorney General. And I'm proud to have been elected twice now, with a hiatus in between, when the Republican Party took over the legislature for 2 years. And then I came back a year ago and was sworn in. So, but the Attorney General's office is the largest law office in the state of Maine, and I happen to think it's the best law office in the state of Maine. We do a great number of things, all in the public interest, and we represent the state agencies when they get sued. Sometimes we bring proactive legislation, litigation or legislation, both. We prosecute all the homicides in the state of Maine, along with the state police and the Bangor police and the Portland Police Department. We do child support enforcement. We do child protection cases in the courts across the state of Maine. We prosecute fraud and computer crimes. We do investigative work for state agencies, and we investigate all instances where deadly force has been used by a police officer. We represent the natural resources agencies of state government and the professional licensing commissions and boards in state government. So if a plumber or a doctor or a nurse has been sort of brought up on charges, if you will, we would prosecute that case in front of a board to see if the license of that person should be suspended or revoked. So the chief medical examiner's office is within the attorney general's office. So all unattended deaths, all sort of suspicious deaths, are governed by our laws.
And once you, there have been two sessions where you were elected by the legislature to be our attorney general. Once you are elected and confirmed, where is the oversight relative to the, how much of that becomes politicized? And does the AG have a boss, or is it the legislature in general who has oversight? Or is there a sense of autonomy and independence which is appropriate? As an example, when our governor says publicly, tell her to sue me.
He wouldn't say that.
You think our governor is incapable of saying indelicate things?
I was prepared to sue. I said to myself, he shouldn't tempt me.
He
took my advice, though, so that was good.
Well, he's taking somebody's advice. if he's taking anyone's advice, I consider that kind of a good day in Maine. Yeah. But, relative to the relationship between the attorney general in the executive branch, being the governor and the state legislature, is it set up where there are walls of accountability and walls of impartiality?
Well,
because you're the people's attorney, right? You represent the interests of the state and the people.
I represent the public interest. We don't give legal advice to individual citizens, but I represent the public interest, and I can wear many hats. I can defend or represent a particular agency like the Department of Health and Human Services or the DEP, and at the same time, in the same litigation, I could place an ethical wall between myself and the lawyers actually doing that work, and I could go to court and take a different position in the same litigation, representing what I perceive to be the public interest. So as an independent constitutional officer, the attorney general does not report to the governor or report to the legislature, nor do we represent the legislature or give legal advice to the legislature. That's also a misperception, because you would think, where the legislature elects you, you'd kind of be beholden to them. But in the legal sense, no, not so much. We try to help the legislature. We try to prevent laws from getting passed that might result, that would result in lawsuits, expensive litigation to determine and establish the constitutionality of various measures. So we're called upon fairly frequently to advise committees of the legislature or leadership in the legislature in both parties to say, that's an interesting idea, and as a matter of policy, that's your decision, but as a matter of law, it's really not the way to go. It creates a Commerce Clause problem. It creates a free speech problem, some kind of constitutional issue.
Interesting.
We try to keep them out of court, Steve.
Well, I think with what's going on in Augusta, that is almost a Herculean task.
It's an everyday burden.
let's talk about the issue of, and again, I don't want to talk about this in an overly political lens, but in the case of our governor defying you to sue him, and the issue there was the welfare study done by the Alexander Group.
Freedom of access interest, yes.
So was that case or that conflict more about just freedom of information relative to the details of the contract, whereas you wouldn't take a position on either the viability or the effectiveness or the contract itself? You were
correct,
advocating and fighting for transparency and saying the public has the right to know the financial details, yeah, and the scope of the contract?
Yeah, exactly. I was aware that there had been freedom of access requests made of the governor's office and of the Commissioner of Health and Human Services for that draft report that was due in early December, and that the request had gone unanswered for more than 3 weeks. But the governor was clear in his press conferences that he had it in hand, and so I looked at the law. People in my office looked at the law, and we couldn't find a way to say it wasn't a violation of the law not to release the contract. So we advised him, I advised him personally in writing, that he really needed to release the contract.
And what's the status of that?
He released the contract.
And so it's no longer an issue in terms of, at least for the freedom. I mean, it may be an issue relative to the contract and the economics and the finance, but relative to the AG's office, you're satisfied?
Yeah. I believe that the freedom of access requests that were then pending were satisfied. There may be others relating to other aspects of that contract, but I was satisfied that he released the report that he was requested to release.
Okay. A couple things I want to talk about briefly, in that in as a country of law, where I tell my kids and I tell folks I work with all the time, but when people are critical of government, and I'm a fan of government, the complexity, the foundation, the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, the brilliance of our founders, and they may not have gotten everything right, but to me it's just democracy, and our form, our Constitution is just brilliant. But you can't go from here to a mile up the street without seeing all the different elements where government's involved, whether it's FCC regulations over these microphones or this radio thing or MDOT or highway or...
I'm not responsible for that.
You're not responsible for all...
I didn't do it, Steve.
I know it's not your fault. By the way, we have Attorney General Janet Mills here. But to me, law is fascinating. And as the different levels of law, and I wanted to start at the top relative to the Supreme Court, and our United States Supreme Court has 9 members. And I want to ask you a couple specific questions. One, it's one of the only offices and certainly one of the most critical branches of government that doesn't have a set tenure. And there's a couple of our justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's now 81, and Anthony Kennedy is 77, and Antonio Scalia. First of all, from your perspective in your legal career, in your career in government, do you think that it's appropriate for the United States Supreme Court to be free from any of the political pressures of having a term? And any thoughts on the United States Supreme Court?
Sure. It's not just the U.S. Supreme Court, Steve. It's also the federal district courts and the circuit courts of appeal. When a person is appointed to one of those federal courts, federal positions, it is a lifetime appointment. So it's hundreds of other judges who sit in federal district courts and appellate courts across the country who have lifetime. George Mitchell had a lifetime appointment to the federal district court sitting in Bangor. And in 1980, the governor called and said, "Would you like to be a U.S. senator? Take the risk of running less than 2 years later against David Emery, who was way ahead in the polls." And George Mitchell gave up a lifetime appointment to the federal bench. Pretty good position to be a U.S. senator and take the risk that in less than 2 years he wouldn't have either position. So those are real jewels in the legal field, and that's the way it's been for many, many decades. The U.S. Supreme Court I have a great deal of respect for. There's a great diversity of opinion among the justices. I was watching Justice Kagan on TV this weekend, and I'm reading the biography of Justice Sotomayor, whom I had the pleasure of speaking with last month in the Supreme Courtroom in Washington.
Those are two of the most recent appointed by Barack Obama,
they
right?
They are. And Justice Ginsburg I have met. She is older, and she is somewhat frail and has had health issues. But everyone who should know, says she is still sharp as a tack. So
that's
God
great.
Bless her. William O. Douglas served well into his 80s, and he was married to his wife Kathy, who was in her 30s, so... Go figure.
How about Clarence Thomas?
Clarence Thomas?
He's famous for not speaking.
Invisible man.
he's visible. He's just not heard from frequently.
Yeah.
In terms of, I don't know, he's been serving for 22 years and 5 months. But during, you know, when people appear before the U.S. Supreme Court and hear arguments, it's common for the Supreme Court, the justices, to ask questions of clarification. And he hasn't virtually said anything.
More importantly, in his written opinions, in his opinions and dissenting opinions, he's kind of unbending. He's not compromising, not flexible. He doesn't see doesn't seem to see the other side of the issue.
So his approach is much more maybe technical and rigid, where here's my belief and here's how I'm going to vote, and I'll be in the minority or the majority, but interesting. What about, let's move on to another non-controversial issue like Citizens United, because most people, I think, hope that the Supreme Court is impartial because it is the law of the land. That is, you know, as you go up the food chain from local and district and state to federal to the U.S. Supreme Court. There is no other court of appeals from the U.S. Right. Supreme Court. So when they set precedent and they set law, everything else becomes subordinate.
Yeah, it's done.
So a Citizen United, which, and I don't know all the details of the case, but I think it started as like a documentary case, and then it kind of veered out of control to campaign finance, and then it veered out of control in terms of companies having some of the same rights that were before that held by individuals
the right to contribute money for a political campaign, including advertisements, and I think that was in Hillary Clinton's campaign.
But it seems like one of the worst laws, and it feels to me as, you know, I've watched an awful lot of Law and Order on TV, so that's where my legal training comes from. I've got a degree in the, and when the music bing bing hits in my head, I mean, I immediately think, I'll stipulate
the first
to something.
Thing we have to tell jurors in a jury trial.
Forget
put aside whatever you saw on TV.
Forget Law and Order.
But if you read Jeffrey Toobin's books, his most recent book, culminates in the decision on Citizens United, and it's a really good
exercise. I've read it, yeah.
Yeah. And he talks about how it was based on precedent that was to the opposite effect, and there did seem to be political aspects to the decision. It is a shame. You know, the Supreme Court is very well respected. I respect it. I revere it, but they do make mistakes. They made mistakes in Dred Scott. They made mistakes in other areas, and they're not infallible.
It feels like that in this case, though, because it is very politicized, and because now, as opposed to 100 years ago, there's much more intense focus on each member of the Supreme Court, that it's more difficult for them to evolve or change from a position. And it feels as though, like in the case of Citizen United, is there any mechanism, and I'm sure there's always appeals and people will try to reopen it, for them just to say, we've got that one wrong. We're nine people. We're nine human beings. Yeah. We come from nine different backgrounds, and we may have overreached. Or do you think it'll be something that'll be decades before we're able to change it?
Yeah, not only are they nine different people, but they're not that dissimilar in their backgrounds. And there isn't one of them, since Sandra Day O'Connor left the bench, there isn't one of them on the Supreme Court who's ever run for elected office. To me, that's a potentially fatal flaw in that scenario. That group of people should have somebody who's actually served in public office and had to run for office and be part of one of the other branches of government. That's my thinking. But anyway, there's very little you can do except call for a constitutional convention, develop another case with similar facts but not quite on point, to try to test the principle again. More disturbing is the New Mexico case that came down just a year or two after Citizens United, which took the wind out of our sails under the Clean Elections Act. New Mexico's act was modeled on Maine's clean elections law, and they found unconstitutional matching funds. Now, the idea that if you have $4,000 or $5,000 to run for the legislature, and your opponent is running traditional, you know, soliciting money from every company in town, every union or whatever, and then they get to a certain amount, they match your funds, and then they go over that, and you can't have matching funds from the public purse because that, as the Supreme Court said, I think erroneously, that would chill the richer person's free speech rights. Now, I don't get that. You're still allowed to spend as much money as you want on your campaign if you're a traditional candidate. We're just giving the other person a small amount of not fully matching funds, but small amount of some, you know, matching funds to try to level the playing field. I don't see what's wrong with that, but the Supreme Court found that to be a violation of free speech. You know, I think that was carrying it way too far.
I agree. Speaking of carrying things way too far, you are Maine's highest constitutional officer, legal officer. Talk a little bit about the effect on lawyers in government. And again, present company accepted. You are an attorney, and your service in the state house and the legislature is I've followed your career and big supporter of your work. But
when you
look in Washington, and to some extent, lesser extent, I think on a percentage basis in Augusta,
much less,
a higher and higher percent of in the Senate and in the House in Washington are lawyers. And obviously, legislation is technical and it's based in law. So having some understanding in the technical aspect of the Constitution and law is important. But it feels to me as a non-lawyer, but a law and order viewer, that when we have so many people looking through the same lens, through a legal lens, and when so much of legal training comes from a platform, when folks go to law school where on Tuesday you're advocating for one side of an issue in, as part of legal training, and on Thursday you're arguing another, that offers, I think in some cases, a kind of flexibility, kind of an intellectual flexibility. And I know it's based on Constitution and everyone deserves a defense, but if you become that pliable and you're not anchored in your principles, and we have, whether it's 70 or 80% of the folks in D.C. who are trained lawyers, do you share my view that it would be more healthy to have larger, different segments of people representing Washington, or do you think that having the legal training is very effective and for government, whether on the federal level or on the state level?
Well, I think legal training is helpful. It was helpful to me. Washington is a little different. They have a whole stable of lawyers for every committee, and everything they do, there are lawyers attached. At the state level, though, there are very few lawyers, very few practicing lawyers in the state and state house. I counted maybe eight, I think, although I haven't, you know, gone through the whole list. There are several people, four or five people who have law degrees but who don't practice law, who haven't practiced law in a long time, if at all. And, I mean, Roger Sherman in the state Senate, he's term limited. He has a law degree, but he's never practiced law, maybe for a year at one time. Then he went to teaching chemistry, I think, at high school. Right. And that's what his career has been. So, but to me, lawyering is also wordsmithing and understanding. I've argued about 100 cases in the Maine Supreme Court. I know that when you're defending a law or attacking a law, every comma makes a difference. Every adjective, every pronoun, every period makes a difference. And that's my part of what I like to do is look at a bill and make it a good law, make it something that will withstand scrutiny in a court of law.
We have Attorney General Janet Mills here in the next few minutes. Talking about law, now, we may not have many members of our state legislature that are lawyers, but we certainly seem to have a lot of law firms intersecting the state house.
Really?
And I think you know Harold Patius quite well, right?
I know Harold.
Harold and Severin, and it feels like all the major law firms have not, I don't, some are maybe lobbyists, but some are people that are representing legal interest. But, and by the way, Harold Patius, who I've met once briefly, what a fascinating backstory.
Yeah.
Assistant
working
was
for Lyndon Johnson.
Assistant under Bill Moyer.
Bill Moyers,
he told me a story once about Lyndon Johnson calling him up at 6 in the morning about something in the paper.
Yeah.
You can't make it. And when you go to his office, it's like a national archive of all the pictures of Air Force One. But it feels like we have a lot of lawyers on the peripheral of Maine politics.
A lot of lobbyists are not lawyers, too.
Right.
If you look down through the list of lobbyists on the website of the Maine Commission on Ethics and Election Practices, you'll see a lot of people who are not lawyers and never been to law school. Then you'll see some law firms that have now a sub-practice in their firm of government relations, and the government relations group will have some lawyers and some non-lawyers. So it's, you know, it's always been part of many law firms' practice to lobby the legislature on behalf of clients to get certain things done. And then there are a lot of non-lawyer lobbyists who work for the public interest as well, not just private clients. So you see a lot of lobbyists who prefer to be called advocates, who advocate for nonprofit groups and different interests who have a stake in the state budget.
They do not prefer to be called parasites.
Prefer,
I am kidding. Kidding.
Nobody prefers to be called parasites.
Nobody, you're right. Even parasites, I'm sure, would argue that they have some sort of pollinization insect role in the world, and parasites is pejorative. the deadline for Affordable Care Act, that doesn't directly fall under your umbrella.
It does
but,
not.
But there are legal elements to it relative to the state and relative to the impact. Does the Attorney General's office have any issues going on with the deadline coming up for health assurance, or is that something where if there are cases that drive from that, you'll just deal with them case by case?
Really, no. I can't. I don't anticipate any litigation over that, no. And we've tried to make it, you know, take a small part in getting the word out with people, along with Consumers for Affordable Health Care and Wendy Wolf's group. So, but no, we don't have a role to play in terms of the law, implementing the law.
Okay, final question. Yeah, you were the first woman in the criminal division of the Attorney General's office, first woman district attorney in New England, and one of the first in the country, and also the first female attorney general for the state of Maine.
First and second.
First and second. First and second, with a little break and
just a little sabbatical.
A vacation in between.
Yeah.
As a parent of two daughters who I am, you know, I was at a sports event this weekend in outside of Boston. And there were equal number of boys and girls teams.
Yep.
And I was trying to think, I used to teach sports. I was an adjunct professor teaching sports business in Title IX. It was one of the final acts that Richard Nixon signed before he jumped in the helicopter and took off. But women in business, women in politics, women in sports, so important. Talk a little bit about you've never either campaigned or you've never highlighted. There's never been Attorney General woman Janet Mills. You've always been based on your credentials and based on, but as a woman here in Maine and as a woman who's really broken barriers and you've done so, what are your thoughts in terms of how we get more young women inspired to become more involved in all areas?
Yeah, you know, I'm always optimistic, but it's always I'm always a little bit frustrated. I look around. I want to see more women in law enforcement. There are really good jobs that women could take advantage of, jobs with benefits. I want to see more women plumbers and electricians, women in the trades, women in construction. Those are pretty good paying jobs,
right.
And some of them require a license.
What are the barriers to those things?
I don't know. I'm trying, you know, getting my head around it. Is it something that, you know, there is a group in Waterville called Hardy Girls Healthy Women, terrific group run by Karen Heck and Toby Schneider and some other great women role models. They're getting middle school girls out in into the wilderness and going to fix cars and learning new things among themselves, just girls doing non-girly things, and it's really made a difference.
Well, you've certainly have, not just for girls and women, but I think for Mainers in general, have had a career, and your whole family, as I mentioned before, your brother Peter is a 7-time Maine State Senator, and he's heading up the Turnpike Authority now. We had Dora in here recently. I think she's Vice President of Clinical Affairs at University of New England.
Yep.
And thank you so much for coming here. It's been an honor meeting you, and thank you for your service to the state. And, you know, look forward to the next time our governor suggests that you sue him.
Don't tempt me.
Be as aggressive as you want. I think that's appropriate, and would love to have you come back sometime.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
We've had Janet Mills. She's Maine Attorney General. For anyone interested in the Office of Attorney General, you can go to www.maine.gov/AG. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O. This is News Talk WLOB 1310 AM.